Blog Talk Radio.
Each day do you wake up and get out of bed? You got all these feelings rushing round in your head. You got that bout with doubt and neighbors singing the blues. Pick up the paper and it's all bad news. But you know in the end, happiness is your best friend. You can be what you wanna be. Oh, dare to step high and live like you're free. I said color, color your life happy. Color, every day you can choose. Color, color your life happy. If you choose happy, there's no way you can lose.
The difference between try and triumph is a little funky. We all have ups and downs, but you can still be happy. If you're gonna step, you might as well step high.
If you choose happy, there's no way you can lose.
ColorYourLifeHappy.com. Get your happy on.
Good morning and welcome to Color Your Life Happy for Monday, April 12th. I'm your host, Flora Brown, coming to you live from Anaheim, California, as I do every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. Our show today will inform, inspire, and encourage you. In a moment, we will begin today's episode, Color Your Life Happy, Joy After Tragedy. You're going to be listening today to my guest, Diane Bunnell, a novelist who will share a powerful story of religious hijacking that was all too real for her. She turned it into a novel, but it's based on her real life story. So you're going to be really empowered by listening. So stay tuned for that. But first, I want to welcome all of you, my listeners. I'm so honored that you made space in your schedule to join us today, and I encourage you to participate by asking questions or adding comments. Now, here we have a little static on the line, but that's okay. We're going to keep on going. If you're on the phone lines, you need to press pound 1 to let me know that you have a question or a comment if you'd like to. Of course, you can just listen in. If you're on the web chat, you just type in your questions or your comments, and I'll be able to see them and read them on the air. Let me remind you, too, that the show is live, so that means anything can happen. Lost signals is the most common thing that happens, but, of course, we have the static on the line. It happens, too. So don't worry about missing anything. All the shows are recorded and available for you later under on-demand episodes, so you can always get back to the show page to copy the show, to listen to it, whatever you choose. The show is also available on iTunes, so if you subscribe to iTunes, you'll be able to get the show there without doing anything except subscribing. Now, I'm your host again. I'm Flora Brown. I'm an author, a coach, an inspirational speaker, consultant. I'm also a mom of 4 and a grandma of 3. Now, I recently retired after 40 years of teaching junior high through university levels, and I just couldn't wait to get started on my next career. And it has become Color Your Life Happy, a full variety of things that I do. I hope the static is going to leave us in a minute. I invite you to visit my website, Color Your Life Happy, to sign up for my free weekly newsletter and blog. And while you're over there, by the way, if you are a local Orange County or Los Angeles resident, you can now join me live in person, in the flesh, twice a month, the second and fourth Thursdays. We have an activity that's called From Overwhelmed to Overjoyed, Creating the Life You Want. We meet at 6 p.m., and to get the details on that, all you need to do is go over to my website, ColorYourLifeHappy.com, and you will see a link that'll take you to the meetup page where you can sign up. Okay, on this radio show, Color Your Life Happy, we talk about the many ways to create the lasting happiness you deserve in all areas of your life. Each week, to get at that goal, I interview guests from different fields, such as self-help, spiritual journeys, relationships, change and adversity, parenting, wealth creation, career, all those things that contribute to our lasting happiness. Today, my guest is Diane Bunnell, author of The Protest. Hi, Diane.
Good morning, Flora.
Hi. I want to tell my listeners a little bit about you before we begin. Is that okay?
Sure.
Oh, great. Well, it sounds like when you started speaking, the static went away. So, wow.
Oh, wonderful.
What power. What power. Great. Diane Bunnell is author of The Protest. This is a novel that was inspired by the real-life religious hijacking of her only two daughters at ages 10 and 12. I mean, just to hear that just grips my heart, and I'm sure it does the same for all of you, especially parents. Diane is a magna cum laude graduate of Whitworth College with a BA in English. She received her teaching credential some years later from St. Martin's College. Her career includes executive secretary to a U.S. congressman, executive secretary to the CEO of a hospital, high school English teacher, where she taught students from incarcerated to honor students. That's a broad range. Mm-hmm. But some of those overlap, don't they?
Mm-hmm.
Currently, she works in the president's office of a two-year college in the state of Washington. Her novel, The Protest, is a page-turner. And when you go over to Amazon and read some of the reviews, you will get confirmation on that. But the fact that her story is inspired by the real-life religious hijacking of her own two children is what makes it irresistible to many readers. Yet, Diane is surprisingly balanced and appropriately sensitive to light, has this wonderful sensitive voice. She's used her experience to travel the country, speaking and inspiring hope in those who have experienced similar traumatic situations. A great story. The Protest is beautifully written and is full of understanding. It's about experiencing and turning the experience into wisdom, about pain and conquering. It's about joy and becoming. Listening to Diane is an inspiration, and I'm so thrilled that you made time in your schedule, Diane, to come and share with us. Thank you. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Flora, and I thank you for having me on your show. I'm very happy to be here.
Well, I am delighted that you're willing to share your story, because all of us need to hear stories such as yours to empower us in our lives. Even though we may not have the exact or identical experience, we can certainly grow and learn from yours. And when you share it, instead of keeping it to yourself, share it with others and with the world, as you've done by writing the novel, it's very important. So thank you for doing that. Now, your novel is inspired by the real-life religious hijacking of your only two daughters, who were 10 and 12 at the time. So could you tell us a little bit about that story? I'm sure everyone is eager to know how that came about.
Yes. Well, first, let me explain what I call a religious hijacking. Picture yourself getting onto a plane for a trip. You know exactly what your destination is going to be. But if the plane is hijacked, it takes you to a place you never intended to go. Yeah. And it's the same with religious hijacking. Had you known in advance of seeking a relationship with God that your closest relationships would be destroyed, you would never have agreed to pursue such a distortion of religion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so that's what happened to my daughters. I'd been a single mom for about 7 years, and then I remarried, had a wonderful marriage with my second husband. And within a couple of years, when my daughters were 10 and 12, they were victims of what Stephen Hassan, who is the author of Combating Cult Mind Control, he has endorsed my book, he talks about brainwashing. And in the court system, it's known as alienation of affection, which is close, but not the same intensity of actual brainwashing.
Mm-hmm.
And with my girls, their sweet personalities were broken down and rebuilt into basically scripture-spouting zombies. I'm talking eyes glazed, speaking in monotones. They turned into rigid little boards if I were to hug them. And I asked them one time, if you don't believe I'm a Christian, and mind you, this is simply because I didn't go to their fundamentalist Christian church, and you say that I'm not under the influence of God, then who am I under the influence of? And they answered that I was under the influence of Satan.
Mm-hmm.
They called me their biological mother and began addressing me as Diane. And eventually it got so bad that I slept with my bedroom door locked at night because I didn't know what I was dealing with, but I knew these were not my loving daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And finally I gave up the fight because I didn't want them to be torn in two psychologically.
So what do you mean by gave up the fight?
Well, it was we were at that point in a court battle, and it was about 9 months into it that the guardian ad litem is interviewing both parties and interviewing the children, coming back and saying, I just don't get this. There's nothing that I can see that's going on here or that I any indication of anything wrong, but they just have these bogus ideas about, you know, not wanting to live with you. And I'm sure I was on the receiving end of it, so I don't know what happened, how it happened, but I do know that they were scared to death that they were going straight to hell if they didn't go to the right church, it was a very exclusive feeling, and excluded anything that was not of like kind, so.
Okay. How did they get involved with this particular church or belief? Because it sounds like they were still living with you at the time they first got introduced to this.
Okay. Well, and that was their, I was divorced, and so that was the religion of the non-custodial parent situation, which I don't really go into too much because I part of getting through this is not buying into the
the
blame and all of that. It's just trying to understand and trying to forgive and trying to get through. So
But it was the non-custodial parent's religion that they were drawn to.
Right.
His particular religion, and it sounds like they chose to listen to it, but they just got absorbed by it.
Well, actually, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was saying, and then decided that because you did not embrace it, that you were the enemy.
Well,
you
used the word they chose.
Mm-hmm.
And they really didn't. Until I read the book, I really didn't understand how this could come about because I'd always thought of myself as a great mom, had a really loving relationship with my daughters, and then boom, all of a sudden, out of the blue, it was like they were just, our bond was gone. I mean, they treated me worse than they would a stranger on the street kind of thing.
Oh.
And Stephen Hassan in his book talks about that break coming because they're at whether they're children or adults, it doesn't matter how strong the love bond is or how intelligent they are. He talks about there being a vulnerable moment. And with my kids, the idea was that, they were the sun around which my life revolved around for so many years. And then I had remarried, and they had to share my affection and attention with stepdad and a couple of stepbrothers, and that's where the wedge was able to be worked in, and that's what Stephen Hassan talks about as working on that angle of vulnerability and love bombing and very subtle kinds of, and like I say, I don't know what actually happened because I obviously wasn't there, but just subtle kinds of coercions and fear-inducing, and then finally it gets to the point where they really are just terrified in Stephen Hassan's book, and I believe my daughters were too, with the idea of not belonging to whatever fanatical persuasion the victim belongs to. That's the way that happens.
Well, tell us the name of Stephen Hassan's book again for listeners who might want to consult it.
Combating Cult Mind Control.
Cult Mind Control.
Stephen Hassan, right.
Okay. How do you spell the Hassan? Is it
H-A-S-S-A-N.
A-N. Okay. Now, did they eventually leave and go to live somewhere else during this time frame? Okay. And where did they end up living?
With their stepfather, with their dad and their stepmother.
Oh, okay. So they went to the non-custodial parent then. Mm-hmm. Not to a compound or something like that. That's what
no.
I was thinking at first. Okay. Now, why did you choose the title, The Protest? Why did you choose to name your book, The Protest?
Well, the title works on a few different levels. First, it's main character Jane's protest against the injustice of the situation she finds herself battling against.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's a play on the protests engaged in by the congregation of the Fellowship toward a women's health clinic where abortions are performed. And
okay.
Finally, it's my form of protest, of course, about what my girls and I went through.
Mm-hmm.
And Kafka said, if the book we are reading does not wake us as with a fist hammering on our skulls, then why do we read it? A book must be an ice axe to break the sea frozen inside us.
And oh, my
goodness.
My
book, my protest, is Kafka's ice axe. It's a cautionary tale that's larger than my singular story, and it serves as a warning
mm-hmm.
and as a beacon of hope.
That's interesting that you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you next why you chose to do it as a novel rather than as your own story, and you just kind of answered that by making it a novel, you were making it bigger
right.
than it, just your personal story, correct?
Yes. Steinbeck yeah. is one of my heroes. You know, I'm an old high school English teacher.
Right.
And literature is really important to me. And Steinbeck was always the champion of the underdog and bringing truth to light. And so I really admire and tried to follow his example of bringing things to light through
mm-hmm.
the larger picture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that Kafka quote, that was powerful, especially the last part, that a book must be an ice axe. That, would you repeat that ending? Because that was powerful.
Must be an ice axe to break mm-hmm. the sea frozen inside us.
Whoa.
Isn't that an awesome quote?
Kafka. That's awesome.
Just an amazing writer.
He's talking, of course, about books that that have strong messages of this sort, but I wonder
mm-hmm.
if he also was applying it to any kind of book that we choose to pick up. Do you think?
Well, I think the ones that are fists hammering on our skulls, the ones that are that ice axe, and I see the sea frozen inside us as all of us just having so much knowledge about so many things, but so often we're so contained and frozen over that we really don't access those until you have something that just shatters whatever limited existence and limited knowledge that you are operating out of.
Right, right. And not only limited knowledge, even if it's unlimited knowledge, if you are just holding knowledge but not acting on it,
mm-hmm.
then I don't know how valuable that knowledge is. One of my coaches a long time ago used to say, you know enough, now you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
sometimes it
don't
sounds
sit on
like
the fence. Office,
right, just sitting on the fence, knowing all this stuff, but sometimes something has to break that and to get us to act, and that sounds like what this quote is referring to. Now, losing your daughters must have been the hardest thing in the world. I mean, I have three daughters and a son, and I can't
mm-hmm.
imagine this, and I'm sure the listeners feel the same way. So how did losing them affect your life?
Well, it was very hard, and when I lost them, I had to get through the grief, and what I found is I just felt like that I had to find a new way to define my life
mm-hmm.
because
mm-hmm.
now my motherhood didn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
I did have stepsons, of course,
mm-hmm.
but my own daughters were gone, and that was the inception of my motherhood, and so everything was different now, and
mm-hmm.
I came away with a more realistic view of the harm that can be done in God's name, and mm-hmm. I don't have any qualms about talking about fanaticism, religious fanaticism. It's aggressive and it's dangerous, and I mm-hmm. believe that we all have a moral responsibility, like doctors who take a Hippocratic oath, to first do no harm in the practice of mm-hmm. our religion. Mm-hmm. So I have a really clear sense of that out of that experience. And isn't it interesting that as chance would have it, when that door closed, I was able to recognize opportunity that was knocking mm-hmm. in other forms to sort of wow. pick me up and move me on. First, in the form of my writing. I mean, writing this book, it took me 10 years to complete this novel. And wow. it was just, it was very therapeutic, as lots of writers find.
Sure.
And secondly, the opportunity came in the form of a new career in teaching, where mm-hmm. my motherhood expanded to hundreds of teenagers in my high school classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd start the school year saying, "Welcome to my classroom. We're going to have a good year. I'm a Mama Bonelli. I teach because I love teaching and I love all of you. Why else would I get up at 5 o'clock every morning? Now, this doesn't mean you can misbehave in my classroom because I'm going to come down on you, but that doesn't touch our bond. You know what I mean?"
I love that. Oh, I just love the fact that you pointed out that you saw this as an opportunity, or it became an opportunity. I don't know if you immediately saw it that way, but the fact that you recognized that you had to redefine your life.
Yeah.
Brought up these two areas that have now, these two ways of dealing have now helped so many others in the world. And this is just wonderful that you took that direction instead of closing off to yourself
oh, yeah.
and feeling sorry and just sinking yourself into this deep abyss of that would be very hard to pull out of. Now, were mm-hmm. you were still working, you were still teaching throughout this whole process and mm-hmm. managing your life day to day, all the things that we have to do for life. Mm-hmm. So how did you hang on to your sanity through this process?
Well, it wasn't easy at times, but I just had to realize that I couldn't change the reality of what was, as hard as mm-hmm. it was to accept. And mm-hmm. I'll be the first to say that when I recognized I couldn't change things, I just made the conscious choice to put it in God's hands. And the only thing I could do was pray for my daughters that they'd come out of this psychologically okay. So that's what I did. That's how I helped my daughters, because I couldn't help them any other way.
Right.
And the other thing I did was, to have patience and hope, even though the books that I finally put my hands on that shed some light said that they most likely would never come back to the way they were. I would never have them back. Mm. They were just too severely alienated. I never mm-hmm. gave up hope. And I think a mother always hopes.
Sure,
but even that didn't dominate my life. It had its mm-hmm. own place in my heart, but my main focus was on the gratitude for what I had in my very blessed life.
Mm-hmm.
And I had told myself that no matter what happened, when I finished my life, I did not want to look back and see that I hadn't lived it honorably.
Wow.
And that meant I took an inner vow to take the high road no matter what happened. It was hard sometimes, but my
sure.
moral compass, we all have a moral compass, and it just kept showing me that if I lowered myself to fight this war, then I would have been allowing myself to be brought down to the lowest level. And
right.
Then I would have lost everything, not only my girls, but myself.
Yourself, that's right.
And
that's
that was something fundamental that I just knew. No matter how devastated I was by the loss of my girls, I, not my adversary, was in charge of my choices.
Wow. You just said a powerful set of things here. One, I want to repeat some of what you said because it's so important. First of all, the fact that you faced the reality that the situation was what it was and you couldn't change it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing that was very important is that in spite of the fact that this situation was revolving around religious fanaticism, you didn't let that dampen or kill your belief in God.
Oh, it made it stronger.
And it made it stronger, and so put it in God's hands.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also pointed out that the literature you were reading was giving you the doomsday version of how this could end, but in spite of that, you still held on to patience and hope and looking at the gratitude. I mean, looking at how you could things you could be grateful for in your life, that is so important because we tend to just not see anything else when we are focusing on whatever the problem is, big or small,
mm-hmm.
and then making a conscious decision. I'm so much a believer that we have to make a conscious decision. We have to choose. You didn't choose how they lived their lives or what they chose to do, but you certainly had the choice of how you were going to respond to it. And look at what taking the higher road did for you. I mean, taking the higher road not only helped you personally, but look at how it's helping all the rest of us who are now hearing your story. And even though we don't have perhaps the same identical experience that you have, we still are benefiting. We still are helped because we all have something in our lives that will try to make us crazy. And especially parents, I think we have a special challenge to work with. But I am so happy to hear the things you did because this is exactly what we all can do. And I'm also happy you said it wasn't easy, but that you took that inner vow and
mm-hmm.
you just kept going back to that high road each time. Now, with such a loss, lots of people would have been very bitter at having their beloved children completely alienated against them. So what was it like? You've told us a little bit about what it was like, and now you told us how you reacted to it. Could you go a little deeper into what that was like?
Yes, it was, you know, it's like having your heart torn out. It's you're so filled with sorrow, and, you know, I was sad and I was angry at having my daughters taken from me emotionally, and the sadness sometimes felt like it was too much. And even when I gave them up, I struggled with the question of whether it was the right thing to do,
right? Uh-huh.
About whether I'd be able to forgive myself. And yet at the same time, I knew that everything I said to my girls was poison used against me. So that, you know, it just had gotten to the point where there was nothing I could do but accept and make the one decision that I could make.
Mm-hmm.
How to live, how to go forward,
mm-hmm.
and what was best for them, which I felt was mm-hmm. to get out of this psychological war.
Mm-hmm.
And so out of that, I just came to the conclusion that when we're given life, we are required to define it. And I think the way we define it or limit its definition, it's up to us.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So when, you know, the tragedy happened, I grieved the loss. That felt healthy. And then I got on with my life before
mm-hmm.
I had gone too far into the grief so that I was defining myself by grief. No way was I going to define my life by grief.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing
mm-hmm.
to do with the love I had for my daughters, but it was my life's definition that mattered once they were gone.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's powerful. The fact that you were suffering a type of grief, because many people think of grief only with the physical death of someone, but the loss of your daughters from your immediate presence, from your love, was a type of death. So there was a grief period that you needed to go through. But so wonderful, it's so wonderful that you didn't get defined by that, because I hear people talk sometimes who are sharing sad stories, and you ask, you know, when did this happen? And you think it's recent, and you'll find out that it was 20 years ago or whatever. Mm-hmm. Because they are still victims, and they're still caught up in the grief. They haven't made it through that process. And this is just wonderful for you to share how you are going to have these times. You are going to struggle. I like the fact that you admit that you struggled with whether you had made the right decision or not, whether you should have kept fighting this psychological war. But you made the decision that it was not benefiting. It wasn't benefiting you or them. So this is wonderful. And this, I love you saying we're required to define our own lives. And we are. If we leave it up to someone else, we're not going to like the outcome.
No.
They are not going to have our best interests at heart.
No.
Now, there's some in the audience, I am very sure, who know someone who's struggling with this issue, or they themselves are struggling with a situation maybe where loved ones have pitted against each other to alienate themselves from them, or they don't know what to do with this kind of situation. Tell us what you learned that helped you cope, and I know it'll help the listeners as well.
Well, you know, I really didn't have any clue what was going on, as I mentioned earlier, and I was feeling really terrible, wondering what could I have done that could have made such a complete break, and, you know, I was just at a loss. And then, very interestingly, you know how serendipity works. Things happen at a particular time in a particular way that it's just perfect timing. Well, mm-hmm. I was in Ashland, Oregon, one of my favorite places to go, and I was walking along a sidewalk, and there was this book sale, and there was a table that had Stephen Hassan's book on combating cult mind control on there. And mm-hmm. my husband said, he had been looking through it, and he handed it to me and said, you need to read this. So I started looking through that book, and it seemed like every page was a description of my girls.
Wow.
And he explained how the change occurs, and boy, talk about a huge relief. I mean, finally something made sense. It all fell into place where, no, I hadn't done anything wrong. It was just this particular vulnerability. In fact, one of the things I do is I go around the country talking at colleges too, because college kids are often victims of fanatical
yes.
groups, because they're
yes.
at a very
yes.
vulnerable place in their life, and everything's new, and grades and finances and love interests that can go up and go down and, you know,
yes.
and bottom out. And it puts them in a really particularly vulnerable place, and so that they could be easy prey for these kinds of groups. Well, that's sort of
yes.
the situation my girls were in with this remarriage of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And so the book explained quite a bit, and when he explained how the change occurs, and it's not a result of the things that you would normally think, it helped
mm-hmm.
me tremendously. And he says,
oh.
And so for people who might be going through this right now, Stephen Hassan says that you should not say disparaging things about the fanaticism your loved one is attached to, because
okay.
that will just drive the wedge deeper between
right.
you.
Okay.
And in his book, I can't go through the whole book right
sure.
at the spur of the moment here, but he does describe what can be done to get through to your loved ones. And through the story of my novel, I give some insights into the courtroom dilemma and how to deal with what the judge sees, and that is that your children, quote, unquote, hate you, and how
mm-hmm.
to get across what's really going on. And I even, at the back of my book, it's not very common for a novel to have an appendix of resources,
wow.
but I do list books that you can read on it. I also list a couple of attorneys who I researched at the time.
Mm-hmm.
The book was published in 2003, who have fought such courtroom battles. One is
wow.
on the East Coast and one on the West Coast.
Okay.
And unfortunately for me, it wasn't until too late that I found out most of this information, so I couldn't apply it to my own situation. But I certainly feel that that's one of the reasons that I was just driven to write this book, to get this out there for other people.
Mm. And it sounds like to me that even people who are not going through the exact issue or situations that you went through still can be helped, because we all are going through something. And one of the things you said that struck with me was to avoid saying disparaging things
mm-hmm.
about the religion or the situation. And we can also apply that to our children's choice of mates or choice of other things they do, it doesn't seem to help the situation to
no,
say
it doesn't.
Disparaging things. It just does not.
Makes things worse sometimes.
Exactly. So, and I want to share with you, I'm sure you've probably seen them. I don't know if you've been over to Amazon lately, but I went over and took a look at some of the reviews. Have you looked at the reviews of your book lately over there?
No, not for a while.
And the different people who have left reviews have just had wonderful things to say, not just about your story, but even your writing style. One lady says, Bunnell's characters are credible. Her ear for dialogue is superb, and she avoids the trap of being overly didactic. And that's wonderful to know, because mm-hmm. preaching at people, as you just said, it doesn't help. Yet it's her understanding of the mechanics of manipulation, how zealots use fear, intimidation, warped logic, perversions of the law, and twisted interpretations of scripture that made the greatest impact on this reader. This reader also
wow.
says, I confess to losing a fair amount of sleep during the read, and just recalling some passages starts my teeth grinding.
Hmm.
The protest tells a compelling story and gives the reader a very personal look at a phenomenon that has been given all too little publicity. It should be required reading for anyone who calls himself a Christian.
Hmm.
So that's a powerful thing. And one
nice.
Of the other reviews
yeah,
said
you.
That your book should be a recommended for community library collections and a personal reading list. And I think that particular reviewer said that their book club read it. So this
mm-hmm.
is where taking your situation and turning it into an opportunity is so powerful, because look at, not only have you come out of this with joy, but look at all the other people you're going to help, just as you were
mm-hmm.
helped by Stephen Hassan's book. And I'm glad too, when you read his book and as you read all the other things, that you didn't fall into this trap of thinking that all this has been said, so there's nothing more for me to say on the topic. This is one of the things that I hear from my clients who are writing books. They think, you know, they're kind of hesitant to get into it because they think everything's already been said. Well, it has not.
No.
And there was an aspect of it that you could tell that nobody else could tell your
mm-hmm.
way. Now,
that's right. And, you know,
yes.
as an English teacher too, you know, when I'm teaching a novel, I know that there are some novels that really speak to my kids. And there are other
mm-hmm.
novels that don't. And there, so you never know what you are going to say. You in particular, at this point in time, you with your personality and perspective, that's going to reach out and touch somebody. So
right.
absolutely.
Yeah,
I agree with
important.
What you're saying.
Now, how did you avoid the bitterness? Because now you have a joy for life. How did you avoid the bitterness that would just be so easy? How did you stay down that high road? Because I'm
well,
sure the bitterness tried to come up.
You know, I've always been a happy person. And I just, when I looked at my situation, I thought, you know, I'm not going to let anything or anyone take that away from me. That's precious.
Oh, that's
and
wonderful.
I think that's a conscious choice about what we dwell upon. You know, you've heard that what we dwell upon grows.
Right, exactly. What we think about. We bring about.
Right, right. And I just couldn't let the loss of my daughters color everything in my life. So
right.
Instead, I chose to be grateful for everything, every day that was good in my life. My loving and supportive
mm.
husband, Ernie, my two stepsons, a new career as a high school English teacher, and all the kids who love Mama Bonelli, my friends and my family, warm summer days, cold nights in front of a beautiful fire. It's all in our attitude. It's the
yes.
only
yes.
thing that is 100% within our own control, no matter what happens to us.
Oh, so true, so true. Oh, my gosh, we have only 5 minutes left. I can't believe it. You have to tell us the real-life ending. What happened to your darling daughters?
Well, what happened with my daughters is that about 6 years after I had no contact, I mean, all of my letters were returned to sender, and I wasn't allowed phone contact. And what I found out later is my daughters were not allowed to check the answering machine, to check the mailbox. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were at their end, too. They were cloistered. Mm-hmm. And one night I picked up the phone, and I hear this voice on the other end of the line say, "Hello, Mom. It's me, Anna."
Oh.
And it had been 6 years. The last time I had heard that voice, it was a 12-year-old voice, and now she was 18.
Oh, my goodness.
And tears of joy. I mean, it was just, as much as I had held on to hope, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful shock that night. I'll never forget it. Now, I didn't hear from my youngest daughter for about 10 years. And she had been younger when it happened, and she was just very deeply affected and couldn't quite bring herself to be open to the possibility. But both of my daughters are in my life now. We have a beautiful relationship. One lives in Seattle about an hour away. The other one is going to school in Texas. And
wow.
I couldn't be happier.
Wow, that is so
wonderful. I think
wonderful.
Those prayers of mine for their psychological safety must have worked.
Yes, because it sounds like they were able to emerge from that unscathed, or as unscathed as possible. I'm sure that all of these experiences have an effect. But it sounds like they, too, have gone on with their life. That's such a beautiful story. And I'm sure everybody can feel that. What that felt like to get that phone call from your daughter. That's just amazing. Now, I was going to ask you to read a little bit from your book today, but we have about 3 minutes left. So quickly tell people where they can get a copy of your book. That's important.
Yeah, that's fine. Well, you can get it on Amazon. That's probably the best place. I noticed you had a little icon on your site there.
Yes, yes.
So,
and I think if people click on that, it'll take them straight to Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Okay. And what you'll find there is that you'll find some really good prices for copies of the book. And then if you go way down to the bottom, almost the bottom, you'll find my link, and it's full price. So, c'est la vie. That's the way it is in the book business.
That's true.
But
well,
there are some very good... Yeah, that's the best way to get a hold of a copy. And there are copies out there in the libraries, too. So check with your local library if you can't afford to actually, you know, invest in a hardbound book.
Okay.
Or, you know, it's a good story.
It's a fantastic story, and I'm so happy that you wrote it.
Yeah, it's nice to have something hopeful come out of something so dire. I think that's...
Yes.
That's the thing I'd just like to leave
wonderful.
You with.
Well, I want to thank you so much. We have been chatting with, learning from, being empowered by Diane Bunnell, the author of the novel The Protest, which is actually based on her real-life story. And as we have learned now, the end of her story was a happy ending and a wonderful story that we can all grow from. We're near the end of today's show, and I urge all of you who have been enlightened, encouraged, empowered, to please tell others, share this with your family and colleagues. You can download this episode after the show is over. You can go to iTunes and get it. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you, Diane, so much for coming on today. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome.
And
thank you, Florence.
And you're most welcome. I invite all of you to join me again next Monday, April 19th. At 11 o'clock, that we will have another inspiring and exciting show. I also encourage you, those of you who are local in Orange County or L.A. County, California, to join me at From Overwhelmed to Overjoyed. This is an in-person group that gets together twice a month to work on our goals and getting to the happiness that we all deserve. I am your host, Flora Brown, of Color Your Life Happy, the radio show designed to help you uncover the joy you deserve. I'm coming to you live from Anaheim, California, every Monday at 11 a.m. I'm here, Pacific Standard Time. Have a blessed week, and remember to color your life happy.
Each day do you wake up and get out of bed, you got
all these feelings rushing round in your head. You got that bout with doubt and neighbors singing the blues. Pick up the paper and it's all bad news. But you know in the end, happiness is your best friend. You can be what you want to be. Oh, dare a step high and live like you're free. I said color, color your life happy. Color, every day you can choose. Color, color your life happy. If you choose happy, there's no way you can lose.
The difference between try and triumph is a little funky. We all have ups and downs, but you can still be happy. If you're going to step, you might as well step high.
If you choose happy, there's no way you can lose.
ColorYourLifeHappy.com. Get your happy on.